all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossum with VeteransRadio.net.
I am your officer of the deck today, Lieutenant J.G. Type. We have two great programs for you today that I think you'll truly enjoy. I know I did in talking to these individuals. Before we get started on the interviews, though, we want to mention our sponsors, Legal Help for Veterans, a veterans disability law firm handling claims all around the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. Our VSO sponsors include Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter, 310, in Ann Arbor, Michigan, American Legion Post 46 out of Ann Arbor, the VFW Graft O'Hara Post 423, and U.S. Wings, which provides those great giveaway leather bomber jackets. They've been online. Find them at uswings.com. We also want to encourage you to go to our website, veteransradio.net, and help us out with a few sponsorships, maybe some buddy money, maybe being involved in buying some of our new swag at the VeteransRadio.net swag store. That also helps promote and keep this program on the air. And now to our interviews. Well, we're pulling together a couple of interviews for you based on the unusual times we're in with COVID-19. All around the nation, people are sheltering in place. Even VA hospital visits have been limited. The military has pulled back on transfers of personnel. It has reduced deployments. It has stopped training exercises, all because of this Wuhan virus that arrived last year out of China. You might think, well, this is, you know, really unusual, which it is, but it's not the first time that we've seen such pandemics, flus and plagues causing interference with life in general and the military specifically. So we're going to have a couple of interviews today, one dealing with the Spanish flu and COVID-19, kind of how lessons to be learned, and then the plague in Los Angeles and the military relationship to all of that. And then we're also going to talk about some concerns about the use of hydrochloroquine, quins in general. The President of the United States has been talking about it. It's causing a lot of controversy. But we have sort of an expert on not the efficacy of the drug for treating certain types of viruses, but the military were given this for anti-malaria drug, and it causes some problems. So we're going to talk about that. Maybe you had that experience. So sit back and enjoy. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio Jeffrey S. Copeland, a prolific author and a professor at the University of Northern Iowa. Jeff, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Jim, thank you for having me back. It's always an honor.
Well, it's always great to talk to somebody who loves storytelling as you do, and you've really sort of had a career here. You've authored or edited over 30 books, Plague in Paradise. We're going to talk about the Black Death in Los Angeles in 1924. We've previously talked a little bit about Inman's War, a soldier's story of life in a colored battalion of World War II. We've talked before about Lieutenant L.C. Ott's top secret mission, the Pioneer World War II flight nurse behind Medevac. So we're glad to have you on today, and it's kind of a weird time. We're sitting here talking remotely with our social distance, our appropriate social distance.
Yes, we are.
Because it's everybody in the country is worried about COVID-19 or the coronavirus or Wuhan virus, depending on what you'd like to call it, here in 2020. And sometimes we forget these things have happened before. COVID-19 is causing the military to adjust a number of its operating premises, not moving guys around from base to base, thereby spreading a particular virus or flu, not having folks go from one country to another country on typical rotations or training assignments, again, to try to stop the spread. You know, where they learned some of these earlier lessons became known as the Spanish flu in 1918. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Really, it's one of the things that we have to learn from the past on all of this. And actually, travel restrictions and quarantine through the years have really been the ways to go. Going back to the Middle Ages with the Black Death, the Spanish flu during World War One, the Black Death again in California in 1924. But let's focus just for a little bit here on the Spanish flu outbreak. You know, recently here, many experts have decided that the Spanish flu actually started in China in 1917, spread to Europe, and then made its way over here to the United States after that. It ran its course in about 2 years, but in that amount of time, roughly 30 million people worldwide died of it, and some estimates say 50 million, some say 100 million, that may be a little bit high. But basically, we have a very strong lesson we can learn about what happened in the United States at that time. The first true known case of this happened around Fort Riley, Kansas, Camp Funston. And once one person was infected with this, it literally did spread just like wildfire. You know, the Spanish flu we know as basically H1N1 virus, which is similar to what the bird flu is today. But at that time, there were no major drugs or vaccines that could be used. So basically what they eventually tried to do is they tried to close schools. Sounds familiar. My university's closed down now. Theaters, I just read today, the same thing is happening nationally. Businesses were closed up, same thing happening right now, and a major quarantine. But the problem with this was we were in a shooting war at that time. So we were still sending troops overseas. There was some talk at the time of maybe halting the progression of troops. But at the time, it was thought that if we stalled too much on this, it would allow the Germans to get themselves reorganized and go on another major offensive. So troops kept getting sent over. Now, remember, they had to be sent over by troop ship, which gave plenty of time for plenty of folks aboard ship to get sick if anybody had caught it in the United States and taken it with them. So a lot of these poor soldiers in the trenches during World War One became so weak they couldn't fight, so they were taken back to hospitals where they proceeded to infect everybody else.
Well, and the word today is social distancing, and anybody who's been on a troop ship or has been on a Navy ship of any sort just knows how close the quarters are. And we were taking, maybe unbeknownst to the military leadership, we're taking guys from various camps, army camps all around the United States, putting them on these troop ships where they're cheek to jowl, and by the time they get to Europe, they've just, infected the whole ship, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. And the problem during World War One, as I said, is we really didn't have any kind of drugs to deal with this. So pretty much it was try to keep people as comfortable as possible, try to get their fevers down if possible. But the reality was the mortality rate was incredible once a person was infected. You know, my grandfather lived to a ripe old age of 94 years old. He was born in 1911. He was a little kid when the Spanish flu outbreak came out. He lived in the Ozarks, and he could remember and always told us stories of whole train cars of bodies coming through the town where he lived, people who had died from the Spanish flu. And the same thing happened all over the world at that time. And that was actually called the Spanish flu sort of erroneously. Spain was a neutral country at that time. The king of Spain caught it. So the media started talking about him and his illness and other people who were catching it. So people wrongly thought that it was a Spanish disease, but the reality was the other countries did pretty much a media blackout and didn't allow word to get out so morale wouldn't get low. So the one thing today with the internet and instant news around every corner, I don't think we're going to have the wool pulled over our eyes too much, but it's something we have to be concerned about. There was an outbreak of the Black Death in San Francisco from 1900 to 1904, and then there was the outbreak in 1924 in Los Angeles of the Black Death. That was the last major outbreak in the United States. And in both instances, there was a total media blackout by design. And I'm telling you what, in San Francisco, it cost the mayor of San Francisco his job, eventually the governor his job. When the U.S. Surgeon General found out that people were keeping their mouth shut about this, and when the Black Plague took place in Los Angeles and they did the same thing, finally, somebody stepped in and said, now, wait a minute here. We can't have this happen. People have to know what's going on. So do you know that because of the outbreak in 1924 of the Black Plague, that's why the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta was founded, so that there would be an oversight to keep local people from hiding what was going on to help stem the spread.
Well, and
that's
really
interesting.
It's really, yeah, it is interesting, and it's important to understand the history because it ripples through time. As we deal with COVID-19 and the information or the lack of information, it not only was jumping around between American soldiers and the rest of the country, they get over to Europe, and it, now everybody in Europe's got it as well, the French, the Germans. Something like, in looking at some of the research here, 11% of the 1.2 million soldiers in the United States in 1918 were hospitalized with the Spanish flu. The death totals in World War One, combat deaths were roughly 53,000. The number that died as a result of the flu and pneumonia was 45,000.
I know. Can you imagine?
It's a good time to look back at some of these historical events and carry them forward and see are there some lessons we should learn. And you bring up the plague, the Black Death that occurred out in California kind of in two runs. You've written in particular about the 1924 experience out there. First off, tell us a little bit of what the Black Death is, and then tell us that story.
Oh, sure, I'd be glad to. The book is called Plague in Paradise, The Black Death in Los Angeles in 1924. And what happened was a ship came from China to the port of Los Angeles, and rats got off of the ship with fleas carrying the plague. So the rats got off, the fleas got off with them, and the plague manifested itself first in the Mexican community in Los Angeles, the Macy Street District. So basically it started with one family, the Lujan family, and then it started spreading like wildfire from that. But here's the thing. All right, the first doctors called in, looked at the patients, and they said, uh-oh, looks like the Spanish flu has come back. And that was how it was initially misdiagnosed. But the plague, there are three forms. Bubonic plague that people usually get first, and that's where they get these large buboes. They're like large lumps full of pus and blood. And it starts out bubonic, high fever, aches, pains, incredible headache, dehydration, that kind of a thing. Then if they live, it goes to the pneumonic stage, which goes to the lungs, and can be spread through droplets, airborne transmission that way. And if they live through that, it goes septicemic, which means it goes to the bloodstream. Well, it took a very skilled doctor at Los Angeles County General Hospital, Dr. Matthew Thompson, who went into the Mexican community. He had remembered studying the symptoms in medical school and said, now, wait a minute here. I think we've got something else going on. So he brought in a couple doctors who had worked during the outbreak in San Francisco about 20 years before. And they said, yeah, you've got the Black Death here. So what the city officials decided to do was both on one side of the ledger, what they thought was really positive, but on the other side of the ledger, not so much. Because in a nutshell, here's what happened. They were touting Los Angeles at that time as the paradise of the West. They wanted everybody to come out and help with all the new industry out there, the brand new East Port of Los Angeles and everything else. And the last thing they wanted was to be known as Plague City. So the city officials immediately put a total and complete news blackout. They even stopped people at train stations coming in, took away their newspapers and magazines because word started getting out to other cities about the plague. So a total news blackout. Second thing they did is they managed to get as many World War I veterans as they could from the area, deputized them, gave them guns, posted them all around the Macy Street area where the Black Plague was building, and said, now look, use any and all means. We can't have these individuals get out of there because it's going to spread like wildfire. So the veterans of World War I were some of the unsung heroes of this. Now, they didn't ever have to shoot anybody, but they were there on guard to talk to people and help explain, look, we've got to stop this, and the best way to stop all of us to work together, you need to stay in here. And medical care was brought in, but it was a very severe quarantine. Everything was shut down in that part of Los Angeles, and that's the only way they were able to contain this.
Well, and, so, and those veterans had seen what happened with the Spanish flu.
Exactly.
When they were serving, if you didn't quarantine the sick folks, and so
they wanted to help out as much as they possibly could. And there were actually stories of the veterans sneaking in food and other supplies to the individuals in that district. Incredible acts of kindness, which does not surprise me in the least. Eventually, they had to do, quote unquote, a cleansing of the area in order to get rid of the rat. So they had to literally burn down most of the area in order to get rid of it. At that time, that was about the best they had, because for medicines at that time, you'll love this, to treat the Black Death in 1924, they gave aspirin, which didn't do a whole heck of a lot, but then they gave them IVs of mercurochrome. Now, do you remember when you were a kid, if you got a bump on your knee, your mom would come out with a mercurochrome and put a little on? Well, it has mercury in it, so they
stings
figured...
And it stings like heck.
Yeah. But what it did do is they figured, well, it's got mercury in it, it's going to help cleanse the blood, but it killed just as many people as it actually helped. There was a plague serum being developed back out east at that time, but unfortunately it wasn't developed in time to save a lot of the individuals. But today, of course, we're a lot better with the science involved with this. So hopefully with what's going on right now, we'll see a lot of progress here pretty quick.
Do you see the advances that we'd all hope happened between 1918 and 1924?
Well, considering back then, especially with the outbreak in Los Angeles, it was left to local control only. There wasn't a CDC or a World Health Organization at that time. We progressed a great deal. Now, the problem is people travel a lot easier today than they ever have before. I mean, think about it. Back then, we basically had trains as the major form of transmission, and not a lot of people used the train system back then. Cars were still relatively young in the 20s. Great distances usually weren't done with that. But the mobility of society today is a game changer. Trying to make sure that we practice some kind of social distancing and quarantine at the same time today is something that we know has to take place. Hey, during the Middle Ages, half the population of Europe died of this, the Black Plague. All right, then the Spanish flu outbreak, depending on which expert you believe, 30 million to 100 million. And then the Black Plague is still around. There are still pockets of it all over the world. Madagascar last year had another major outbreak. So the outbreaks are nothing new. How we handle them has changed dramatically, but there's still so much we need to do in terms of informing people what to do. I heard one official last night say, that she was very upset because the younger people are acting like nothing is happening right now. They're still out partying in groups and they feel asymptomatic. They feel fine. Well, the case may be everybody, regardless of age, is going to have to pull together with this because the younger people can transmit it. They may not get very sick with it, but they can transmit it to others who are just going to die.
Yeah, that, so and this, clearly that was the younger group in World War One under the Spanish flu. Those would have been young soldiers, you know, the healthiest of the healthiest who contracted this and lost their lives at such a high percentage. We were talking to Professor Jeff Copeland, who's a prolific author, and in an earlier discussion, Jeff, you told me it takes about a year of research and 6 months to write many of these books. How did you get interested on this topic of the Black Death in Los Angeles in 1924?
Well, you know, the topics for my book sort of seemed to fall out of the sky to me. I was actually in an airport killing time after I had done a book event for the book before that, and I was leafing through a magazine. And I was reading an article, and it made a reference to the outbreak in Los Angeles in 1924. And I thought, wait a minute here, I've never heard of this before. So I started doing a little research when I got home, and the more I dug, the more I saw, wait a minute here, I smell a rat. Literally, literally. All right, so what I found out was they tried to cover it up as best they could at the time. And again, all you have to do is tell me you can't get the information and I'm not going to take no, I'm going to dig. So the more I dug about this, I had to ferret out records everywhere. And to be honest with you, a lot of people did not want me to get the records because even though that's almost 100 years ago, people are still not really proud about a lot of the things that happened at that time. I mean, there were some wonderful people, the veterans who helped out. There were some business people at that time that really just said, hey, you know what? It's just a small population in the Macy Street area. Let's let them die and that'll take care of this. Seriously. So it wasn't a story that was told a lot because this is why the Centers for Disease Control was formed, to take away local control where people can decide who will live and who will die. So once I got involved in the research with this and started digging a little deeper, it was tough. Jim, I'll be honest, it was tough ferreting out this information. But I went everywhere. I went out to Los Angeles. I walked off the area. I went to the archives and record centers. And believe it or not, the group that had the best information for me was the Catholic Church, the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. Because one of the heroes of that who helped stop the plague was Father Manuel Bruaya, who was the priest at La Placita, the church that was at the hub of that community. The Catholic Church kept religious records, and I use that word on purpose, religious records about everything that happened. It was a total chronicle of everything that happened from the inside out. And once I got that, I hit the jackpot. La Placita is still there today. They still do, get this, about 3,000 baptisms a month.
Holy cow.
A month. So it's still the hub of the Mexican community out there. A very rich heritage. Just a wonderful place. I got to visit with the current priest there who helped me find the archives and get into the information through that door as well.
Well, we've often heard on Veterans Radio that, you know, and we're talking to Jeff Copeland, that great research leads to great stories, and that's certainly what you've got here in this particular story. And it's just also all too often we find that some event, historical event in the past that maybe we've forgotten about, is rippling through time and is relevant today. And as we look at what to do about COVID-19, whether it's for our veterans in VA hospitals or our military members at different bases or the general public, this kind of story has lessons we can all learn from. Jeff, where does somebody find this book and some of the other books that you've got out there that they may be interested in?
Well, given the current state of affairs, I would recommend online booksellers. Amazon.com has it. If you're a Prime member, the shipping is free. A good dose of reading at this time is going to be good for a lot of folks, I know. But all online booksellers, crowds at bookstores are sort of being discouraged right now. So I guess I'd say the online way is pretty much the way to go. I did want to say also that one of the biggest lessons from the outbreak in 1924 that we learned was try to stay calm. It's tough. It's hard to do. And it's a time for everybody to draw together, to help each other out and realize, look, we can beat this. We can get over this, but it's going to take a village. It'll take all of us pulling together. And that's what we really have to do.
Well, we'd encourage people to go online then and look for Jeff's books. Jeff, thanks for taking some time with Veterans Radio today.
Thank you. And a big shout out to all those who have served and all of our people serving right now. God bless you all.
We hope you enjoyed Professor Jeffrey S. Copeland's historical view and lessons learned from plagues and viruses of the past. As I say, go look for his books. They're easy to find online. And when you come back afterwards, the news here, we're going to get another expert talking about some of the concerns about some of the treatments that have been suggested for COVID-19. Come back on Veterans Radio. Welcome back to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone, your officer of the deck today. We're going to talk to former U.S. Army Major and Preventative Medicine Officer Dr. Remington Nevin in a moment. This is really a timely discussion. Just recently, the Trump administration announced that it was going to run a hydroxychloroquine trial in a Detroit area hospital at Henry Ford Hospital with 3,000 patients. This is to see if a hydroxychloroquine, which is an anti-malaria drug, actually works. Admiral running the Supply Chain Logistics Task Force is also coordinating this with Vice President Mike Pence. So I think you'll find this discussion with Dr. Nevin, who's been on this issue of the side effects of anti-malarial drugs for years, fascinating. So stay tuned. But here's a word from our sponsors.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Dr. Remington Nevin, a Vermont-based physician. He's board certified in occupational medicine and preventive medicine physician. He's a former U.S. Army medical officer and epidemiologist. And we're going to talk about malaria drugs today. Dr. Nevin, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a interesting problem because we all know, anybody who's ever served knows, the government's there to, they're going to prod you and stick you and give you shots, and all of this is for your own good.
Yeah, that's right, Jim. But I should correct you. You know, when the military gives you shots, it's not for your own good. It's for the military's good.
More accurate, yes.
I was in the U.S. Army Medical Corps, and our motto was preserve the fighting strength, not take care of individual soldiers. So it's really all about keeping the force healthy. And as I suppose we're going to see in discussing these drugs, mefloquine and related drugs, occasionally that can lead to individuals suffering some harm.
And that's really something that we've talked about before on Veterans Radio, that you get, you know, you're in this assembly line and you get told to do certain things or take certain drugs is likely to be some impact.
Yeah, that's correct. Today you find malaria mostly in the tropics, but even going back to the time of World War II, we had a little bit of malaria still in this country. The malaria parasite can thrive in mosquitoes that live in environments like the rural South here in America. But through decades of effort, we've managed to eliminate it in this country. But obviously in the war-torn countries that we tend to visit, malaria is still quite endemic. So for most of the post 9/11 wars, areas we've deployed our troops to, there's been malaria present. And the military, as a matter of course, has pretty much mandated the universal use of anti-malarial drugs. It did so throughout our time in Afghanistan and in the first year or so of our deployment to Iraq, and then intermittently after that mandated the use of anti-malarial drugs. Going back to Somalia in the early 90s, we used it. And then, of course, deployments to tropical areas of Southeast Asia and Africa and even South America. You're likely to have been exposed to mefloquine, chloroquine, or some other related anti-malarial drug.
The U.S. military has sort of had a long history with mefloquine. People have been searching for anti-malarial drugs for... But in 1970, some research out of Walter Reed sort of led down a new path. Tell us a little bit about the history of getting the drug to the market and its ultimate intertwining with the military.
I suppose it's important to take a step back and emphasize that really the military efforts of the colonial powers dating back several hundreds of years have been intertwined with the availability of effective anti-malarial drugs. You know, there's a reason the Roman military never conquered Africa, even though it was right there. It's because malaria would have decimated the Roman legions. They had no drugs to prevent malaria. And it was with the discovery of quinine from the bark of a tree that was found in South America that the early colonial powers, particularly Great Britain, was able to extract this drug, quinine, and begin to use it in their troops to permit military activities throughout Africa, throughout South Asia, and in Southeast Asia. So the development and use and exploitation of anti-malarial drugs has been a military priority for hundreds of years. And it was in World War II, or the years leading up to World War II, that our nation, the United States, realized we had a problem because the Axis powers, Germany and Japan, pretty much had a grip on global supplies of quinine from plantations in Java. So we decided to launch a massive effort, a massive drug discovery effort that really rivaled the Manhattan Project in terms of the numbers of scientists involved. And that World War II effort led to the development of a drug called chloroquine, which you're probably hearing a lot about in the news right now related to COVID-19, which is sort of an unrelated coincidence. But chloroquine was our main anti-malarial drug through Korea, through the early years of the Vietnam War, until it started to lose its potency. The malaria parasite began to develop resistance against this miracle drug, chloroquine. And so the same group of government folks that had been overseeing this drug development effort in World War II that led to chloroquine launched a new effort. And that led to this drug mefloquine being synthesized in the late 60s. And then it was developed by the military's commercial partner, Roche, throughout the 1970s and 80s. And it came to market in the late 1980s. So the U.S. military began to use it in earnest a few years later in the early 90s, beginning with the war in Somalia.
Now, at this point, veteran radio listeners are thinking, okay, Dr. Nevin, how many folks have been exposed, if you will, or have been compelled to use mefloquine, take mefloquine as part of their overseas assignment? And the answer or lack of an answer may surprise people. Dr. Nevin?
Yeah, it's really quite remarkable. You know, the U.S. military can tell you exactly how many paint chips are floating around the Earth in orbit right now, threatening our satellites down to the, you know, micron. But they can't tell you, even within an order of magnitude, how many service members and veterans were exposed to this drug, mefloquine. It's certainly well over 100,000. It could be upwards of a million. We just don't know. We don't know. And part of the reason we don't know is that the military kept lousy records. They often didn't treat mefloquine like a prescription drug that was entered into the medical records. It was often distributed like an item of equipment, you know, like your TA-50 if you're in the Army. They would issue it along with your bed net and your bug repellent and, you know, maybe some bug spray. So unfortunately, many veterans that were exposed to this drug don't even know that they took it. And if they believe they took it, they only have their word because they consult their medical records and often nowhere in the medical records does the word mefloquine or Larian appear.
And this is one of these things that, as you say, that we can count everything in the military. I don't understand how we don't know how many mefloquine tablets that the Army purchased and then distributed out to folks. But that just seems to be a fact lost to history, doesn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think we'll ever know for sure. But what we'll end up doing, I think, Jim, is very much like what we've done with Agent Orange, right? Where we've just presumed that if you had boots on the ground in Vietnam, then you were exposed to Agent Orange. And now, of course, if you were Blue Water Navy vet, then it's also presumed that you were exposed. And we didn't have to do that, but the government realized it had no choice because tracing who had exposure and who didn't would simply be too hard. So I think what will end up happening when the dangers of mefloquine or larium are fully recognized is that there'll be these blanket presumptions of exposure if you were deployed to a malarious area at certain times and in certain units to be determined in the future.
And one of the things that I find interesting on this is that there is research where they've diagnosed that 58 service members were diagnosed or reported to have malaria in 2018, and 35 were so diagnosed or reported in 2017. So they can count the folks who have malaria, but we don't know whether or not the folks who had bad reactions to mefloquine are bigger or smaller than those kind of numbers, do we?
So the number exposed to mefloquine is many, many orders of magnitude greater than the number that were diagnosed with malaria. Malaria is typically a life-threatening illness, and it generally will land you in the hospital. It's very unlikely that someone that comes down with malaria will treat themselves or be treated in clinic. They'll generally end up in the hospital, and the military does a pretty good job of counting people who are hospitalized. So that's why we have such a good hold on the number of people that actually have malaria disease. But of course, the purpose of mefloquine or larium is to prevent malaria. The military was thinking that if they just gave this drug out to every person in every unit that was going overseas, that they could eliminate or mostly eliminate these cases of malaria. So to the extent that we saw cases of malaria while we were using mefloquine, that really is a failure of the drug. It's, I suppose, not that surprising that the military doesn't know who took mefloquine, because it's really not a priority for them to be able to determine who took it and who didn't. You know, unlike the number of tanks in the inventory or the number of paint chips orbiting Earth threatening our satellites, you know, those things have a very real an immediate military impact, but the number of troops exposed to this potentially harmful medication, that's a problem for the VA, not the military.
Well, and your research and your area of practice and consulting has focused on sort of the impacts of taking mefloquine. Tell us a little bit about those impacts that some people at least find themselves with.
Yeah, so mefloquine is not a benign drug. It's not really a safe drug when used in the manner that the military has used it in. The FDA permits mefloquine to be marketed still based on its assessment that it's safe and effective when used as directed. But the real problem with mefloquine is that the military has never been able to use it as directed. The real problem with mefloquine is that it belongs to a class of drug called quinolines. Quinine is a quinoline drug. It's the substance that gives tonic water its bitter taste. Chloroquine, primaquine, and mefloquine or larium are all quinoline drugs. The problem with this class of drug is that in some people, and we don't know why, but in some people, the drug is neurotoxic. It actually can injure the brain cells. And we don't have a test to determine who is susceptible to these effects and who isn't. And so the only way we can tell who the drug is safe to give to and who it isn't safe to give to is to give basically test doses of the drug to. And whoever develops early symptoms, what are called prodromal symptoms, things like nightmares, insomnia, anxiety, depression, anyone that develops these symptoms, they're supposed to immediately stop the drug and switch to a different class of medication. And if we were to have done that, we probably would have been able to use the drug reasonably safely without much chronic disability resulting. But the real problem with mefloquine is that the military gave it to very likely hundreds of thousands, if not a million or more troops, and forgot to give these warnings out that you have to stop the drug if you experience any of these psychiatric symptoms. And as a result, soldiers that experience these symptoms, service members who experience these symptoms during use of the drug may have been poisoned by it. Their brains may have been poisoned by the neurotoxicity of this drug.
And there's sort of, I'm trying to sort out in my own mind from reading this, is there mefloquine toxicity as sort of one problem where you get to such a high level you're toxic? And then are there neurological or health issues that may occur for some people at a lower level than a toxic level?
So the general rule is that there is no safe level of a neurotoxicant. So take lead, for example. You know, lead paint chips that are ingested by kids in homes that have lead paint. There is no safe level of lead. Any amount of lead is neurotoxic. And we think that any amount of mefloquine is neurotoxic to people that manifest this susceptibility. So anyone that takes mefloquine, and typically it's within the first few doses, they experience nightmares, vivid dreams, insomnia, anxiety, depression, restlessness, confusion. The drug label says that those symptoms may be considered prodromal to a more serious event. Well, I have to ask you, Jim, what is more serious in your mind than anxiety, depression, restlessness, or confusion?
Yeah, that isn't much. That sounds like it was written by a lawyer.
Well, it was, and for good reason.
Talk about that. Talk about that the FDA, this isn't just Dr. Nevin's crazy idea. This is recognized by the FDA, and they took some extraordinary action.
Well, this has actually been recognized all along. The language I just shared with you is from the drug's original product insert back in 1989. So we've known all along that this drug is particularly dangerous in some people, and hence the urgent warnings to discontinue it at the onset of any of these symptoms. Now, in 2013, the FDA mandated a boxed warning or a black box that basically just emphasized information that was already in the product insert, but it was buried deep in the product insert in those areas that people don't typically read. But in the boxed warning, it drew attention to this idea that you really need to discontinue the drug at the onset of any symptoms. And the reason was to try to prevent or reduce the risk of permanent neuropsychiatric effects. The FDA and the drug manufacturer readily concede that this drug can cause permanent neurologic effects, things like tinnitus, dizziness, vertigo, and we believe that psychiatric effects accompany these neurological effects often. So people will suffer psychiatric symptoms such as nightmares, insomnia, anxiety, panic, often accompanied by dizziness, vertigo, tinnitus for 20, 30 years after having used the drug.
Well, these
effects are permanent.
Yeah, these effects sound like a lot of other effects, right? Sound like effects from PTSD or TBI from an IED or something.
Yeah.
How does a clinician like yourself sort out what the cause is?
So the first step to recognizing these symptoms may actually be due to mefloquine and not to a traumatic event is simply to be aware that the drug can have these lasting effects. And as you alluded to, the symptoms that I described, things like nightmares, dizziness, anxiety, confusion, these sound a lot like the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. And who gets post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury? People who've been overseas to combat zones. And who takes these medications? Service members who've been overseas to combat zones. So this is something that we in epidemiology, in medicine and research, call confounding. There's a term for this, where people assume that some outcome is due to some exposure, when in fact the outcome is due to some other exposure that just happens to be correlated or linked to the exposure that you assumed. So clinicians will see a mefloquine veteran complaining of nightmares of monsters, difficulty sleeping, panic and anxiety, and ask them if they've been overseas, and then readily attribute those symptoms to something that happened to them on deployment. They assume that they saw some terrible traumatic thing during their deployment, and often they did. But what they don't realize is that that service member, that veteran, was very also likely exposed to mefloquine. And so if they ask the question, hey, did you ever take mefloquine? And more importantly, during your use of the drug, while you were using the drug, did you experience any of these symptoms? If the veteran says yes, well, actually, my nightmares started right after I started taking mefloquine. And then they ask more questions. Well, what are your nightmares of? Are they of this traumatic firefight that you were involved in? The veteran may say, well, actually, no, doc. I was having nightmares about monsters and snakes and killing my wife and enjoying it weeks before that firefight. And if the doctor says, well, what are your nightmares of today? And if the veteran says, well, they're not of the firefight, that was nothing. The nightmares that are troubling me are about me killing my wife and enjoying it. That's what's really troubling me. Then you can see it's obviously not post-traumatic stress disorder because the symptoms started before any trauma and the symptoms don't relate to anything they experienced. They're a figment of the veteran's imagination, this horrific nightmare caused by nothing more than the drug. So it's really not that hard in many cases, but the clinician needs to be aware of this possibility, and the veteran themselves needs to be aware that the drug can have these lasting effects.
Well, and I think in today's medical delivery model, if you're not an informed patient, informed consumer, and ask your doctor or your PA or your nurse that you're seeing some of these questions because they're trying to move you along so fast, that kind of subtlety just sort of gets bypassed, doesn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately, in today's model of 5 to 10 minutes with a clinician, the clinician is looking to place your initial complaints into some known diagnosis, and it's very difficult to educate a clinician about this condition if they're not already aware of it. So it's really not surprising that veterans have struggled to get these symptoms recognized and diagnosed for 20, 30 years. But I suspect that as clinicians become aware of this, that this class of drug, particularly mefloquine, is associated with these chronic effects that can mimic post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury, that we're going to see a lot more clinicians start asking the question, did you take mefloquine? And we'll probably see a veritable explosion of diagnoses of this condition, a condition we call chronic quinoline encephalopathy, or simply quinism, a disease caused by poisoning of the brain by mefloquine and related drugs.
Well, the other side of that coin, I suppose, is somebody who is experiencing those kind of nightmares and problems, but doesn't fit the classic, yeah, you went overseas, but you didn't expose, you weren't exposed to the stressor, but you still have this problem. So they're going to tell you you're faking it, or you don't qualify for PTSD at the VA disability level. That's got to be particularly frustrating too for the veteran who says, "Well, you might not think I have a reason to have these symptoms, but I do."
So there's two sides to that. So as you know, Jim, for many years, a veteran had to prove the horrific or fearful nature of their trauma. They had to prove that they were in a firefight. The VA would go through records and actually confirm that you were in some sort of incident overseas. It'd be very difficult in that sort of setting to prove to the VA that a traumatic incident you may have experienced in private, such as military sexual trauma, for example, might have equally been the cause of post-traumatic stress disorder. So I think quite reasonably the VA has let up on that. And for the most part, the VA will simply take a veteran's word that they were involved in something traumatic. And if anything, we've gone perhaps a little too far, because now veterans that very clearly did not have any traumatic exposures and who will even admit to this, who will readily say the most traumatic thing that happened to me overseas was the chow hall ran out of crab legs one Friday, as was the case with my deployment. It was a terrible Friday at the chow hall.
You Army officers really had it pretty tough at some of those locations.
and they ran out of ice cream too.
So that's where the Air Force draws the line.
Well, we were next to the Air Force, so I think that's why we were so lucky. But you can see my point that there are a lot of folks, and I think a lot of veterans will readily attest to this, that there are a lot of FOBITs, for example, that really didn't experience much in the way of trauma, you know, anything that would remotely qualify as what the psychiatrists call a criterion A event, you know, threatened death, actual death, that sort of thing. So what is to explain their lasting nightmares? What is to explain their lasting insomnia, anxiety, panic, depressive symptoms, cognitive impairment? I have seen so many cases that fit that description where simply because of the symptoms that were present and because they deployed, the clinician just assumes that they must have experienced something. And, you know, the catch-22 here is that a failure to recollect a trauma or amnesia to a trauma is also considered a diagnostic criteria. So the fact that you can't remember anything traumatic happening to you will often lead the psychiatrist to conclude that you must have seen a trauma and therefore you have post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a real catch-22, but in a way that I suppose is seen to benefit the service member. But when the service member wants their clinician to acknowledge that this wasn't PTSD, that this wasn't trauma, that this was actually the effects of the drug, then it can be harmful. And if I had a nickel, Jim, for every veteran that told me they have sat through trauma-focused therapies, they've sat through group sessions where people talk about their traumas, and they feel so compelled to make something up just so that they don't feel out of place. This happens all the time.
Yeah, just for those veterans, in the group, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and for those, and if they've never heard of mefloquine and they can't understand why they're experiencing this and they've been told for years that they have post-traumatic stress disorder, you can imagine why they would feel that way, right?
And they're not going to get any better. We're treating
exactly.
the wrong problem.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
So before we run out of time, I want to make clear to folks, this isn't just a U.S. military problem, this mefloquine veteran. There are mefloquine veterans all over the world who are concerned about what taking this drug has done to them, aren't there?
Yeah, that's right. And our group, the Quinism Foundation, which was founded by retired and separated military officers, and senior enlisted, we focus primarily on the plight of military veterans because we know that this is a very good way to gain public interest and support and hopefully research funding. But there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of folks who have been affected by the civilian use of this drug, that have been exposed to this drug. But in those individuals, they're probably less likely to have the condition misdiagnosed as PTSD or traumatic brain injury because they're not military veterans. In those cases, they may be diagnosed with other psychiatric disorders like bipolar disorder, even schizophrenia, because in their case, it's less readily attributable to a presumed traumatic event.
Dr. Remington Nevin, really appreciate the time today, Dr.
Oh, my pleasure, Jim. Anytime.
So as we move forward with testing a related drug, quinine, hydrochloroquine, which you hear about from the current administration to fight the coronavirus, let's remember that it may have some side effects, as Dr. Remington Nevin talks about, for a select group of patients, and not overlook that as well or overlook how it has impacted veterans in the past. We hope you've enjoyed these two interviews, kind of timely topics, different slants on them, things you probably can't hear anywhere but on Veterans Radio. And we appreciate your, as we said at the outset, we always enjoy your comments. Go to veteransradio.net. You can also check us out on Facebook. Go to our website and support us with some buddy money or buying some swag in the swag store. Very cool coffee mugs, by the way. Best coffee mugs around. I really encourage you to buy one or maybe a dozen. Those celebrating Easter, we want to wish Happy Easter. Those who are under stay-at-home orders, we wish you sanity and safety. And hopefully we'll be out of this soon. Come back next week to Veterans Radio. And until next time, you are dismissed.
all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.